Get ready for a week-long celebration of music, community, and fabulous fun with Joy Radiothon 2024. Joy has the largest collection of rainbow podcast content in the world, and you can help keep us out loud and proud by donating during Joy Radiothon 2024. Just go to joy.org.au/radiothon. Mark it in your calendars because Joy Radiothon returns June 1st to 7th. And remember, we all flourish with joy.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
Welcome to episode number 89. This is Sci-Fi and Squeam, and all I can say is it's not a cold war, it's a space war. Or is it a cold war? So remember these words: watch the skies, keep watching the skies. So welcome to Sci-Fi and Squeam, and thanks to TJ and Keza for their great show White Noise and the awesome interview they had with the rock icons, or punk icons, the Misfits. Pretty awesome indeed. Now, that track we just heard was, of course, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, for those who aren't initiated, a 1984 classic pop song, Two Tribes, actually the Annihilation mix. I love the siren at the beginning. It's a 12-inch mix, a little bit too long at 9 minutes and 12 seconds, so apologies if you wanted to hear the whole thing. I might put it on Facebook later on. Of course, produced by the wonderful Trevor Horn, and it came out as a 12-inch on Lovers and Haters in 1984. So this is the episode where, well, like Frankie, we do say relax, but don't relax too much because you never know who's watching you. I would like to welcome back my special guest, Darren Maxwell. Welcome, Darren.
Yes, two times in a row. Yes, hello. Yes. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Now, you're returning to help us here at Sci-Fi and Squeam examine very closely I spy sci-fi films of the Cold War era. It's going to be quite a job to do tonight, I think. There's also a lot of other items that are coming up that I want to discuss too, and that is, one of them is I'm going to phone a gentleman called Neil Foley very shortly for a quick chat about one of our topics which has occurred today on the news, and that is, of course, the banning of the Human Centipede number 2 full sequence here in Australia and in Melbourne. It's the Tom Six controversial horror picture that's just come out here in Australia. It just completed a tour of the country where viewers were invited to see the film in its uncut form. It was set for release on DVD and Blu-ray here in February 2012. I'm not sure what's going to happen there, but it's likely, apparently, that the distributor Monster Pictures will submit the edited version for reclassification later in the year. We'll see what will happen there as I give dear Mr. Foley a call in a moment. I mean, I wonder what the banning will mean for other films, other horror films. Who knows? But it does seem, in my opinion, purely my opinion, that decisions are made and people can't make their own mind up whether they want to see such a type of films. Fair enough. I'm going to play this awesome trailer before we get into the Cold War stuff. And this is Thing from Another World. And Darren, you said earlier before we went on air that this is one of your favourites.
Yeah, it is actually. Actually, it's rather funny because they made a remake of this film back in 1982.
If you're a fan,
you can actually be a fan of both of them. And The Thing from Another World, I think, really set the whole Antarctic sort of storyline off in regards to aliens visiting us. And the fact it was a vegetable, which I thought was interesting, sort of a plant life running around.
Oh.
So James Arness Jr.
Yeah, and of course it came out in 1982 just as The Thing by John Carpenter. And I love that film, Kurt Russell. And the newer version that's come out recently, which, sorry guys, I haven't seen yet. So let's have a listen to that, and then we'll be back shortly to have a quick chat to Neil Foley from Monster Pictures. This is Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9.
The Thing from Another World. This is the spot where it was first seen, and these are the first people who saw the thing. How did it get here? Where did it come from? What is it?
That thing's alive, sir. I saw it. I shot at it. I hit it. I know it. Nothing happened. It just kept coming at me, making a noise like a cat. Captain, it was awful. If you could have seen those hands and those eyes. Captain, you've got to do something about it. You've got...
Is it human or inhuman? Earthly or unearthly? Baffling questions, astounding questions that not even the world's greatest scientific minds can answer.
Gentlemen, do you realize what we've found? A being from another world, as different from us as one pole from the other. If we can only communicate with it.
See?
What happened, Doctor?
In the greenhouse, I was working. I couldn't see.
Yeah.
Then
Then a blast of cold air, and I heard Olsen scream.
Come here. Get in the corner. Now hold this in front of you. Stay by the light switch.
1.9. Needles hit the top.
And this is Sci-Fi and Scream. That, of course, was the amazing trailer of, I was going to call it just The Thing, but of course that's wrong. The Thing from Another World, and that was 1951.
Well, it was in brackets, actually. The From Another World was in brackets. It was like a subtitle, so you can just call it The Thing and get away with it.
We can get away with it. That's good to hear. Now, I've got on the phone line here Neil Foley from Monster Pictures. Welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream. Neil.
Thanks, Sonia. How are you?
Can you hear me okay? Oh, yeah, I'm good. Good, thanks.
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Cool. Glad that you could spend a little bit of time with us. Now, of course, the news today as it stands, the Human Centipede number 2 is banned. Is that correct?
Well, effectively, refused classification is the correct term. They don't say banned anymore.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, effectively, we can't show it. So, yeah, it's been banned. Yeah, which is very disappointing.
And you're the distributors of this film. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, Monster that's
Pictures.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. What does it mean to you and your business as far as the banning goes?
Well, look, obviously, it's a blow. I mean, it means we have to look at our options now as far as what to do. And, you know, I'll be the first thing. Pretty much there's two options that are present to us, and one is to modify the film or to follow the film, to follow this up through. The next legal option for us is to follow it up through the High Court, which would be a pretty kind of expensive and probably fairly time-consuming exercise. So, you know, we're still kind of working out exactly what we're going to do, but I'm pretty sure what we will do is resubmit a modified version and see how that goes.
You met with the board, was it earlier yesterday?
Yeah, it was yesterday. We went to see Sydney, and we had a meeting with the Classification Review Board, which is, I think there's actually four women on the Classification Review Board. Mm-hmm. There's only three of them were there yesterday, and we had a meeting in an office, for 2.5 hours. It was a really kind of full-on process where we, you know, I entered and, you know, my reasons for wanting the film to go ahead, and then we had kind of two experts in with us, one by the name of Laura Crawford and Jack Sargent, who were both kind of fairly versed in these kinds of films and what have you, and Tony Romeo as well, who's the managing director of Monster Pictures. And so the four of us went in there and we presented our stuff, and it was a tough going, and we left and we thought we'd done a pretty good job. To be honest, I just think that I don't, you know, knowing what we've said, and just really don't think we were ever going to win it, to be honest. I honestly think that the mind was made up before we came in, so
it's a bit disappointing as far as, in my opinion, you know, disappointing as far as the ability of people having the right to, you know, see what they want to see. And what happens next then? Will it go to Blu-ray? Are you going to be able to put it through that way? Or does it have to specify?
Well, not really. I mean, any kind of, you know, any sort of sale of it in this territory comes under the classification laws. So we can't put it out any, you know, we can't put it out in any kind of manner unless it's been gone through the classification process. So what we have to do to be able to get it through now, we need to resubmit it and get another rating for it. And I mean, you know, the fact is it was passed, like, I'm not sure if listeners are fully aware, but it was actually passed. We submitted it in May of this year, and it was given an R18 certification. And then what happened, there was a complaint made from the New South Wales the New South Wales Attorney General, who put in a complaint, and then it goes to a separate entity, which is called the Classification Review Board. So we have to resubmit. If we want to resubmit now, it goes back to the original Classification Board, the Classification Board. So it sounds confusing because it is kind of confusing. It's a ridiculous system, really. Yeah. I mean, yeah, there's two kind of separate entities, and one is kind of overruling the other. So, it is a bit of a yo-yo. And so if we submit it now, the same thing could really kind of happen again. You know, we submit it to them and they could pass it, and then someone else could then object, and it could change, you know, it could happen again. And that's kind of, it has actually happened.
And it bogs everything up, doesn't it?
Yeah, their films have kind of gone through this kind of almost like this yo-yo thing. Like,
Well, all I can say is simply keep on the fight, I guess. Because
we're not going to lie down. We have to accept it, but we're not going to lie down. We're going to, you know, we've got a plan on what we're going to do, and just sort of licking our wounds at the moment and working out exactly what we're going to do. But people will certainly be, watch this space is basically what I'm trying to say. Fantastic film, and people deserve to be able to see it in its original form.
Yeah.
And we're determined to get it as close to that form now as we possibly can.
Oh, excellent. Now, how can people find out more about Monster Pictures? What's your website address or...
www.monsterpictures.com.au, or if you go to the Facebook and go to the Mon Pictures Australia Facebook page, and you can sign up for a newsletter, which we send out a fairly regular newsletter, and get all the kind of information about upcoming releases and move things like the disc review process and that kind of stuff. But look, yeah, I mean, anyone wants to get in contact or just send me an email through the, you know, through either the Facebook or through for the website.
Good one.
Yeah.
Okay, Neil, we'll have to let you go there, but thanks again for your time this evening on Sci-Fi and Scream. We'll keep in touch.
Thanks, Sonia. Good on you.
Okay, all the best. Cheers.
Okay, cheers.
Bye-bye. Be back soon after these messages. This is Sonia and Darren, and that was Neil Foley from Monster Pictures. This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Hi, my name is Gareth Edwards. I'm the director of Monsters. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
I'm Japanese. Nishimura Yoshihiro desu. Soshite...
And this is Mark Walko, and we are from Sushi Typhoon.
Yay! This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Hi there, this is Anna Silk, and I play Bo on Lost Girl, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
And here we are back. That was Neil Foley we spoke to earlier, but that piece of music was from... Come on, Darren.
Oh, it's a tough one. It's not it's Forbidden Planet. It's not When Worlds Collide. It's not from the thing. Oh, it must it's be from Day the Earth Stood Still. Oh, yes.
Of course. The wonderful piece of music that is too. And, of course, that's Bernard Herrmann. And he used all sorts of things for that incredible soundtrack from 1951, I think it was. Yeah. And he used all sorts of things. Vibraphones, Hammond organs, electric organs, glockenspiels, marimbas, tam-tams. I don't know what they are. I know what tim-tams are. Two bass drums, three sets of timpani, two pianos, a celesta, two harps, one horn, three trumpets, three trombones, and four tubas. Of course, there was the theremin there.
And you did it all at exactly the same time. That's what makes it so unique. And he played all instruments by himself, by the way. So there you go. No, it was a
clever
joke.
Man.
So there's a joke.
Must have been an octopus to do that. Well, Darren, let's have a look. We are looking at sci-fi Cold War films. And what is the definition of Cold War, I guess, for those who may not remember it or know what it is? Apparently, it is the dawn of the atomic age. And basically, a bit like the song Two Tribes, two different sides of the planet. We're almost colliding with each other to outdo each other in the nuclear arms race after World War II. That's pretty much it, and doing it at all sorts of technological standards and levels. And for you, Darren, what does that sound a little bit like, the Cold War?
Yeah, it was an interesting sort of time that I think a lot of us today don't really sort of realise. We saw a little bit of it in the 80s with the Soviet Union, but post-World War II, when, during the 40s, I mean, the big enemy of the world was Germany. But once the war had finished, people didn't twig that, you know, Russia and America weren't exactly the best of friends. With the advent of the nuclear age, suddenly everybody was trying to arm up to the teeth. As a result of that, everybody started to distrust each other. So, especially from the US side of things, the idea of their Russian counterparts building up their own nuclear arsenal and then eventually sort of starting the space race meant that Americans were afraid of Russia, vice versa. So it wasn't as good a time, or good an era, as what most people thought it was.
No, it was a space race and race on the actual Earth and who was going to get to the moon first, and it did go on and on.
Well, I think the biggest problem they had with it is that the element of paranoia, xenophobia that came with it, and depicted a lot in the sci-fi movies of that time. And there's a lot of movies where they make references to the enemy, but they never actually say who the enemy is. There's only a couple of rare occasions where they'll actually say there's a communist here and a communist there. It conquered the world. They actually say there's actually a communist attack on the town, and the whole town just goes bananas. Of course, it's not a communist attack at all. But there's a lot of references where they're saying, okay, well, there's the enemy, there's those guys, and we don't know who they are. But we all know who they are, they're just not saying who they are. And I think that highlighted the fact that, especially with the US, they were like really, really concerned about a possible invasion from the Russians. It was depicted quite seriously in a lot of their films.
Yeah, I think it went right into the 80s. I mean, look at Red Dawn. I mean, even at that level, I mean, that was the 80s, you would have thought it was over then, but apparently the arms race was at its height as far as productivity was in the 80s.
Yeah, that's well, it would have been. The interesting thing is that a lot had come and gone since then to sort of dilute it a little bit. There hadn't been any world wars for like 40 years, or 30 years at that point, and like the Generation X, who sort of started to come into play, didn't know what a world war was like. They just saw just the tail end of the Vietnam War. And with the Russians, I think that the world had gotten a little bit smaller and sort of people understood them a little bit more, especially with the Olympic Games in 1980 and everything that happened with that.
Yeah.
But I think from the 50s, it was probably probably a bit more prevalent because the nuclear age had just started and nobody really understood it, with the uncertainty as to who was doing what. I think that in the 50s, especially in the 50s rolling into the 60s, yeah, it was actually a lot worse. But yeah, you're right, in the 80s, definitely there was it was still going on. Absolutely, yeah.
And I think the great thing is anxiety can create some great artistry, if anything, which we're going to look at next in some of the movies. What are some of the movies you've got there you're going to talk about?
There are ones that some of these people would have heard of and some of them a bit more obscure. But I think one of the classics, and this is rather an interesting situation, was Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which is the town that's taken over by the pod people. If you look at that film, especially with today's eyes, it is like a perfect example of the takeover of the Soviets of an American town. And yet apparently I believe that actually wasn't the case. It wasn't the story at all. That was just a good story. It's just that people interpreted that way.
Yeah.
And I think that was actually, it was quite unintentional. But when you watch it, you can't help but think that. Like, you know, you don't know who to trust. Suddenly you've got a person here and then the next minute there's somebody else. They look the same, they sound the same, but there's something wrong with them now working for the bad guy. So
that sounds like one of the good ones we'll look at in a moment.
A moment or two more, and you will be the first live Earth people ever to enter a celestial ship.
Hi, this is Oscar Hillstrom, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Hi, guys. This is Eddie McClintock. I play Agent Pete Latimer on Sci-Fi's Warehouse 13, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on 94.9.
Thanks, Eddie. That's Eddie McClintock. This is Sonia, and this is Joy in 94.9. If you'd like to send us a message about one of your Cold War favourites. Alrighty, we're back to the Cold War. Now, we have got some things coming up. Of course, I'm going to play the interview I had with Joe Cornish. But firstly, Darren is here, scratching his head. No, he's not, actually. He's chewing at the bit, because we did mention some of the films from the US, and we've already done The Thing from Another World, though very briefly. What else have you got there that you reckon is a real signifier for Cold War era sci-fi?
I think aside from the impending Soviet threat that everybody was facing back in the 50s, it was the nuclear age that was scaring everybody to pieces. And as a result of that, I mean, everything was responsible. Well, it was, you know, they could just say, oh, well, this is the cause of nuclear energy. And so there were absolute classics. Now, I'll give you a couple of really good examples because these are absolutely rippers. In Attack for the Giant of the Giant Leeches. Sorry, I get that
Goodness.
Right. Attack of the Giant Leeches. Apparently, they were doing nuclear testing at Cape Canaveral, and that was the reason why the
leeches... And when did that come out?
Oh, they were all in the 50s, so I haven't actually written the exact years down, but they all came in the 50s. And of course, I'll just give you two more. Beast from 20,000 Fathoms came out of the Earth because of atomic blasts in the Arctic, which was never a very good thing. But of course, the killer of them all, the one that really set the standard for others to follow, was good old Godzilla.
I was about to say, Gojira.
Gojira. I can never do the Japanese Godzilla. Version. Gojira. Yes, from Japan, especially after World War II, when the nuclear device detonations were so fresh in their minds, they were going to be the thing that was going to start that off. So I think that...
Well, they're remaking Godzilla.
No, they're always remaking Godzilla. And there was all the other monsters that came with it as well. And you've got the Mothras and...
Yeah,
and
Mothra.
But yes.
Gareth Edwards is going to be directing or is in, I don't know, in pre-production at the moment still with doing the Godzilla.
Ooh. But one thing's for certain, aside from a couple of exceptions, if there were any big monsters anywhere, whether it be the ants, whether they be the praying mantis, whether it be just about anything, it was usually because of nuclear testing.
Radiation has done it,
yes. Everything's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger.
And
it's an easy one to sort of get by with, because you say, oh, it was because of nuclear testing that these things are suddenly gigantic, like even in Attack of the Crab Monsters, which is definitely another B-grade movie. It was all to do with the radiation. So radiation is to blame for everything.
I'm going to play this trailer from, and I love it, it's Rudolph Mates, is it Mates? When Worlds Collide. It's from the early 50s, 51. I just love the Noah's Ark concept. You know a bit more about this film than me.
Yeah, it's very funny because in this concept of the film, there's actually two worlds that are coming towards us. And Bella is one, and I can't think of Zok or something.
Zyra.
Like. Zyra. I knew it started
Satellite
with a Z.
Zyra.
Isn't there? And what's interesting is, of course, that one of them crashes with the Earth and the rocket takes off and they just land on this other planet. And it just happens to have an atmosphere, and it just happens
That's
to
good.
Have a civilization that used to be there, and it's got beautiful sunshine. And I always thought, what happens the next day when they realize there's like no one else around and they're stuck there? And it's like, what about in terms of seasons and water? The interesting thing about this story, and as we discussed earlier, is it's a good example of showing how civilized people can break down when panic hits, when the world's coming to an end, and all of a sudden all the great structures you put in place to say, okay, this is how it's going to work, these people will survive and these people won't, and all that just crashes down and becomes a bit of a calamity. And ironically, it was the bad guy in the movie who was actually aware of this throughout the entire thing.
And he's the financial backer.
He's the nasty pasty who's in his wheelchair, and it's actually a very good story with some fantastic visual effects. effects, actually. I think it won an Academy Award for that.
Yes, I think the audio effects are still stunning. Here it is, 1951, When Worlds Collide, and it was directed by Rudolf Mates. Great name. This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Written in the stars is a message of doom for this, our world. And now, in the most shattering experience the screen has ever given you, Paramount tells what could happen within your lifetime when worlds collide. An astronomer checks and double-checks his horrifying discovery. A distant star racing through space toward an inevitable collision with this planet. The United Nations meet in emergency session. All conflicts pale before this threat from another world.
If you wait until the danger is visible to the naked eye, it will be too late to escape.
High on a mountaintop, an army of scientists work desperately to build this giant rocket, this modern Noah's Ark, to carry a few picked survivors of our doomed civilization to a new life on another world, reaching the heights of self-sacrifice, the depths of the animal lust for survival as they fight to be among the few who can be saved.
Let's take the ship away from them! Come on!
Fighting among themselves, fighting against time as doomsday is upon them.
I think all you scientists are crackpots.
Nothing is going to happen.
When worlds collide, you'll see the most amazing, awe-inspiring scenes ever put on film. The forces of nature unleashed in all their terrifying force. Tremendous tidal waves smashing New York City. The molten fires from the bowels of the earth gushing out to consume our world.
Just when you thought it was safe to turn on the radio,
Scythe Cornish, the filmmaker, the director of what I call the UK Chav sci-fi film, soon to be released here in Oz, called Attack the Block. Welcome to Sci-Fi and Scream.
Thanks a lot, Sonia. Good to be here.
Attack the Block is described online as a blast from start to finish, even compared to Neil Blomkamp's District 9. And that's pretty good. And at the moment, it holds an 89% fresh review score on Rotten Tomatoes online. Pretty damn fine, considering it's your debut. So congratulations,
Joe. I
think
it's even up to 90, Sonia.
Oh, has it gone up to 90 within the last hour? That's brilliant.
I like to monitor it daily.
Good on you.
And I think it's gone up to 90. I'm gonna double check while we talk.
All right.
I don't want to lie to you. Every percentage counts.
It does, in little amounts. Now, can you give us a brief rundown of what the film is about?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. It's about a gang of South London kids who have to protect their housing block, their tower block, from an alien invasion.
Yes.
So it's an alien invasion movie with a difference, really. It's on a local level, and it's got a bunch of teenagers who are usually kind of up to no good on their block, who have to find the heroes within themselves when these aliens attack.
And from what I've seen, they do it really well. It does remind me a little bit, just a tad, of like Joe Dante's Gremlins, or even recently J.J. Abrams' Super 8. However, these kids aren't your squeaky clean pretty kids from the white middle class suburbia of America. These kids are from the block, and I think that gives it a real great twist. How did you come up with that idea?
Well, it's kind of set in the neighborhood where I grew up and currently live in South London, so it's a neighborhood I know and love, and obviously there are one or two problems sort of socially with some of the kids in the area and with similar areas around London and around the country and I think around the world, really. So I thought it would be interesting to take what is quite a familiar scenario, the alien invasion, the scenario that usually involves the military and famous tourist buildings, and I thought it would be fun to play out a story like that on a more intimate level and put a group of people at its center that don't usually appear in a story like this. And, you know, for me, good science fiction is often, talking about the present as much as it's talking about the future. So I thought it was a way to examine a part of society in a kind of fun comic book way and make a really unusual alien movie, basically.
Do you think your movie had anything to do with those riots in London? Purely coincidence?
Well, it came out well before them.
Yeah.
I guess there are some thematic connections in the story. You know, the kids in my film feel pretty disconnected from society and feel pretty disenfranchised, and they have to kind of fend for themselves is the idea. So they've built up this kind of skill set that becomes useful when the aliens invade. You know, it's a way of turning kind of bad skills that kids have built up as a mode of survival into something advantageous when this alien invasion starts.
True, they're really independent, definitely.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a bit of a thematic connection, but no more than that, I don't think.
I just love the characters of the kids, of course. Just awesome, especially the part played by Moses, played by John Boyega.
Mm.
How did you come across John?
Well, John's a really brilliant young actor. We came across him when he was, I think, 17, and he was in a play in a theatre in London. He had a very small part. He was on stage for 10 minutes, and he, you know, we could just tell the moment he walked on stage that he was right for the part, and he's great, isn't he? And he's done really well off the back of Attack the Block. He's working with Spike Lee at the moment, playing the lead in a show that Spike Lee's making for HBO, kind of based on the life of Mike Tyson. It's a South London kid who was a very ambitious actor but hadn't done much, who we were lucky to find, and the movie's really been a big kind of launch pad for him.
Tremendous.
And we're pretty confident he's going to be a star.
Oh, he just takes the whole film, really. But the creatures are incredibly inventive and creative. Who came up with those concepts?
Well, that's nice of you to say. The basic idea for the creature was mine, really, and I wouldn't want to give it away
before
people see the film, but hopefully it is unlike any kind of creature design you've seen before, and it's more connecting to the type of movie that you mentioned earlier, really, like Gremlins, you know, those 80s creature features where the effects were a little more practical than CGI. Yes, so hopefully it's a little bit kind of B-movie, you know, inspired. It's not your $100 million CGI kind of nonsense. It's a bit more down-to-earth and inventive, hopefully, than that kind of thing.
It does remind you a little bit of television that's happened in Britain in the last few years. You know, Skins, Misfits, pretty similar, but with a wicked soundtrack. You've got Basement Jacks, which is brilliant, and stuff like that. And you got the king of slackers and drug dealers, Nick Frost. How did you manage to score him for your film?
Yeah, Nick plays a character called Ron in the film. He's a kind of local, buzzy drug dealer type, kind of an affectionate character.
Yes.
Quite a funny character. He's been a friend of mine for about 10 or 12 years, Nick. I'm friends with Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, and in fact Attack the Block was made by their production company, Big Talk Pictures, that made Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz and Pilgrim and Paul. So I just kind of, you know, I wrote the part for Nick and I showed him the script and I talked him into it, really. But I was lucky to have, you know, someone of his status in there. But really, the film's about the young people. You know, we've got this amazing cast of 11 kids in there, and Nick's being very humble and playing a kind of supporting role. And it's the kids that take the lead.
They certainly do. Now, we're doing sci-fi Cold War films in this episode number 89, East versus West. Do you have a favourite? Can you think of one off the top of your head? Sorry to put you in the spot.
Cold War film. Well,
yeah,
I guess,
sci-fi.
Yeah, I guess. Let's have a think. I think The Day the Earth Stood Still is probably the most classic of all those films. Is that the right era, do you think?
Yeah, the 50s. Yep, definitely.
Yeah,
Red's Under the Beds.
That has an amazing simplicity to it. The way the aliens just kind of arrive and plonk themselves down in front of the White House, and how kind of simple the standoff is.
And melts the guns.
It's a really brilliant movie. Recently kind of peculiarly remade by Keanu Reeves in the lead. But I guess that's my favourite. And I guess The Thing would also have to be the other classic. The original version of The Thing.
Yes, I love it.
Which was then so brilliantly remade by John Carpenter. Do you agree?
I agree. I love the remake probably more because of my childhood, but yeah.
Yeah, you have to be careful now because there's a third remake.
I know. I haven't seen that yet.
Which perhaps isn't quite as successful as the John Carpenter remake. Carpenter 1's the one, isn't it?
I love it. I do love it. He's the best on that one. Well, yeah, it's exciting news too. You're doing Ant-Man, is that right, through Marvel?
Yeah, I've been working on that for a little while now with Edgar Wright, yeah.
I love Scott Pilgrim. Yes.
Oh, it's very good.
It is very cool. So you've worked with Steve Moffat as well, I see, on The Adventures of Tintin.
Mm-hmm. I worked with Stephen, yeah.
Yeah.
We were writers on Tintin.
Yeah. Any chance of you doing a Doctor Who episode?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, that would
be
a big privilege. But no, I don't know. You'd have to ask Mr. Moffat. I think there's plenty of very talented directors working on Doctor Who.
Yeah,
already.
To knock on the TARDIS door to try and get him. And do you have any other projects that you can tell us about? Or
I'm writing another thing, but it's very early days.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so really, is Tintin out in Australia yet?
No, I think it's going to be a Boxing Day one.
That's my next
release.
Thing. I'm one of, along with Edgar Wright and Stephen Moffat, I'm one of the writers on Tintin, which is a pretty spectacular movie.
Well,
I think that's my next thing.
Peter Jackson and Steven Spielberg, like, hello. Well, excellent. Look, all the best for Attack the Block, Joe Cornish.
Thank you, Sonia.
And I wondered, before I let you go and leave us from Sci-Fi and Scream, because I've probably got a minute left or less, if I could get you to do a tag for my show, your name obviously, and that you're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy 94.9. Would that be all right?
Of course, yeah.
If we can sneak it in. Go for it.
Hey, this is Joe Cornish, the director of Attack the Block. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Squeam on Joy FM. I've forgotten where it is on the dial.
94.9.
Okay. I'll do that again.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes, ready.
Hey, I'll start again. Hey, this is Joe Cornish, the writer and director of Attack the Block. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy FM 94.9.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. What else should I ask you about? Attack the Block. Now, we've talked about the creatures. Gosh, I think I've probably covered it, really. Anything
else? Don't worry,
Sonia. Don't worry. I think we're fine. We're cool.
Cool. Okay. Well, it's good to speak to you. Thanks for having me on.
And thanks for joining us on Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9, and all the best.
Pleasure. Thanks, Sonia.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
I'm James Griffin from the TV show The Almighty Johnson. You're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream here on Joy 94.9.
Did you see that thing? Did you get it?
We got it.
What was it? It didn't fall. I fired every bullet I had.
So did I. I don't know what it was or what happened. But unless that bag of bones over there can reassemble itself, it's out of the running now.
And this is Sci-Fi and Scream. Welcome back. Yes, indeed. It is a Cold War versus, well, Space War. What was happening? Now, that was Joe Cornish that I interviewed earlier in the week and talking about Attack the Block, amongst other things. Attack the Block is a British sci-fi film, action film, actually, written and directed by him. It's out this year, and it's actually out this Thursday, December the 1st, here in the land of Oz. Okay, Darren, how are we going over there? How are we tracking?
Yeah, we're doing well over here.
We're moving on.
Yes, we're going completely retro here. Yes,
I'm going to look at 1960, The Silence. I don't know if you've even heard this one before, Darren. It's East German.
Oh, okay.
That could be tricky. It's also known as Planet of the Dead, Silent Star, and this is my favourite title, Spaceship Venus Does Not Reply. Maybe that's a bad translation, but that was one of the names of it when it was released in the 60s. It's directed by Kurt Matzik. It's an East German film, of course, from the East German Democratic Republic, and he was a respected filmmaker of East Germany. He was a communist, full-on communist member. And this film is just incredible. It is a propaganda movie, there's no doubt about it. It's overloaded with socialist celluloid propaganda, and it simply oozes with it, literally. The whole premise to this unusual, kind of late Cold War, Eastern Bloc sci-fi movie is about how the communist system is a peace-loving and internationalist community, where all creeds and all peoples of the world are represented fairly and equally, and we can send them to space. Reason being that an object, a strange object, was found in the Gobi Desert, of course, and that object has a message. But the only thing they can get out or decipher from this strange object from the heavens is that it comes from Venus. And so they get together an international space crew, a spaceship, and a robot that can play chess called Amigo, who looks a bit like a toaster with strange teeth, which are little flashy buttons. Anyway, they pop onto the spaceship and they head off, this international crew, to find out what the message was from Venus. And of course, when they get to Venus, Venus is, well, I don't want to spoil it, a little bit empty. So there's a message there, and the message is something to do with nuclear warheads and a world out of control with nuclear arms. I guess you know where it's going, but I won't spoil it.
I guess, obviously, Venus wasn't populated from the same people as in Queen of Outer Space, where it was all populated by miniskirt wearing women, including Jar Jar Gabor. But
goodness, anyway. So, was that a Cold War movie?
Well, or you betcha. No, it wasn't a Cold War movie. It was made in the 50s. So the question is that if you're watching this and it's an East German film, does that make it, they're saying that all the Americans and the Western civilization, the Western world, are all the bad guys?
Pretty much. No. The way they do it is they have an American astronaut, right? Mm. And he comes on board and he basically tries to take over. And it's the Russian cosmonaut that stops all of that happening and creates peace and harmony within the spaceship. There's also a Japanese doctor / scientist / female astronaut, and she's a survivor of the bombing of Hiroshima, which is really fascinating because they keep mentioning Hiroshima all the time and about how the Americans couldn't control themselves. It's a funny film, but it's actually the look of it that I was impressed with. If you just don't think about the boring storyline, you'll actually really enjoy the film for its special effects because it's very famous for, and I have put it on the Facebook site, the Schuften process. And if you want to know what that is, I don't really have time to explain it it all to you, but do you know what the Shuften process is?
I don't, but I was too busy intrigued about the fact that they actually had an American on the show at all, rather than just saying the other. I'm thinking the equivalent
they
of that
on
the American
actor.
Side of it would be Fantastic Voyage, Donald Pleasance as a character.
He's great.
But he turned out to be a bad guy, but they never explained who he was or why he was a bad guy.
Why he was
so
there.
Maybe he was working for the other side, but maybe it's the equivalent of that, because I would have thought, I mean, an East German film. Could you imagine, like, the East Germans have been watching all these films coming out of America for so many years saying that communism is bad and the Russians are bad, yada, yada, yada.
Or
that
aliens.
They would just, they just purely say, well, okay, we're saying that we're good and that the Western civilization, the Western world is just bad. But the fact they had an American on board at all is, quite impressive, actually.
Yeah, well, they actually got an international acting crew, of all things. It was very interesting. I watched the making on the DVD specials, so it was all there and it was very interesting. Like I said, the Shuften process is when a plate of glass is at a 45 degree angle between the camera and miniature buildings. This was before green or blue screens, so this was invented by East German technicians and artists in the film industry. So it was used as late as Lord of the Rings Return of the King in 2003 by director Peter Jackson. He just said the Shuften process was still, to him, better than matte shots in some filming bits and pieces, and better than green screen or blue screen, as it's called now. So that was, I don't know if that's interesting.
So it just goes to show it's all done with mirrors.
It's all about mirrors and angles and cameras,
yes,
man.
In the days when it was trick photography.
And perhaps a bit of magic smoke as far as smoke machines goes. Now, if you want to see this film, it's going to be playing December the 31st, one session only, unfortunately, at 3 p.m. a Saturday, December 31st at ACME. So head on down to, that's New Year's Eve, isn't it?
It is indeed. What a way to see in the new year
do.
With an East German sci-fi movie with an American who's a bad guy in it. Yep.
All right, what have you got there? We've still got a little bit of time, I reckon.
I was just sort of thinking about, if you're living in that era of the 50s, I was just saying the 50s specifically, and there's a lot of like material from that era saying, okay, the war had finished and there was a lot of prosperity, there was a lot of happiness, and obviously Korea had popped up in there somewhere towards the end, and we ended up going into Vietnam, in that it's easy to get a false sense of security in the regards to saying, well, the world is now good and, you know, we're living in a good age now and productivity has increased and then we're at peace, etc., etc., only to find that sort of deep within that psyche was actually the concerns of all the things that were going on in regards to the nuclear age and the communist threat. And of course that gets covered in a lot of films, not just sci-fi but any film really, and that carried right through up even up until the 70s. And as we were discussing earlier, even in the early 70s up until like from say 1968 through to 1975-76, sci-fi movies in particular were all very depressing, all post-apocalyptic, the world has ended, there's no future for mankind anywhere.
I think because America had run out of money.
Well, yeah, and
did
I think also maybe they thought, okay, like the Cold War been going on for now for like 20 years, Vietnam was in full swing, the world was just depressing, and which is why if you wind the clock back, I actually think that you watch the movie The Time Machine. Now, of course, The Time Machine was set in, I think it was like 1900, it was actually the turn of the century, but it was clearly made in the 50s, and you look at how they foresee the future, and they just see it as all doom and gloom, the world's been destroyed multiple times over, and of course when they end up in the future, it's the, as you like, you played Frankie Goes to Hollywood song at the start, Two Tribes, which started with the sirens, and of course in The Time Machine, that's the sirens that sort of set everything off, the big towers that come up and they're blowing the horns, and everybody's just reacting habit to the war sirens.
Sometimes reaction and anxiety makes, you know, great films. Okay, you've got, I'm going to give you about 20-30 seconds. I know this is putting it on the spot, but you have to pick one.
Oh, right now?
One sci-fi Cold War era film, one only.
I think.
And you've got 30 seconds.
I've got 30 seconds. That sort of sums it up to the best of its ability. I would have to say, in terms of just interpreting it directly, I actually think Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Even though, I said earlier, it was unintentional. When you're watching, especially towards the end, when you hear Kevin McCarthy screaming out, watch out, they're everywhere, they're taking over. I think that's definitely the film that's the pinnacle.
Well, we've got to move along shortly, but I do want to play the trailer before we do go. On saying that, Sonia, with Darren. Darren here from Con9 from Outer Space, which I'll get him to mention in 30 seconds in
that's
a moment.
All right,
we'll be back shortly. This is Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Hi, this is Charisma Carpenter, and you're listening to Sci-Fi and Scream on 94.9.
Will you tell these fools I'm not crazy? Make them listen to me before it's too late!
Listen to me. Please listen. If you don't, if you won't, if you fail to understand, then the same incredible terror that's menacing me will strike in you!
Come from another world, spawned in the light years of space, unleashed to take over the bodies and souls of the people of our planet, bringing a new dimension in terror to the giant super scope screen.
It's whatever intelligence or instinct it is that can govern the forming of human flesh and blood out of thin air is, well, it's fantastically powerful, beyond any comprehension.
A cursed, dreadful, malevolent thing was happening to those he loved.
This isn't just an ordinary body, is it?
I never saw one like it. It looks unused.
The sensational star discovery of The View from Pompey's Head. And now an undreamed of horror makes her life and love a vortex of fear.
Jack! Miles, where do they come from?
I don't know.
Suddenly, while you're asleep, they'll absorb your minds, your memories.
I don't want any part of it.
Sci-Fi and Scream. Yes, that is Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And 1956 was a very good year. A very good year. Now, Darren, before we do head off, because it is time to go bye-bye, Sci-Fi and Scream, I want you to tell us a little bit more about Con 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah, Con 9 from Outer Space is an old-style science fiction convention that we're running next year on July 14th and 15th, the Mora Hotel in Richmond. Mm-hmm. And the theme is celebrating the golden years of sci-fi movies, TV shows, and radio. So it's primarily up to around 1965, but our focus is mainly the 1950s, and so we're just getting together to have some discussions about some old films and TV shows and listen to some radio stuff, some radio material. Mm. And we've got a few video programs, competitions, all the rest of it, and all the information can be found at the website at www.con9, that's the number 9, con9 from outerspace.com.
Cool, and you're on Facebook too, like we are. Yes. And we can link you there if you go to Sci-Fi and Scream Facebook, etc. You can go to Sci-Fi and Scream blogspot.com, or you can go to joy.org.au to find the links to everything there. I'm going to have to say goodbye. So that was episode number 89. Of course, next week we'll be back, and I'm going to play a wonderful interview I've been meaning to play for a couple of weeks now with Australian fantasy writer Isabel Carmody. Thanks for coming on tonight, Darren.
That's right, second
once
time.
Yep, second time,
no
lucky.
No worries.
All right.
Watch the skies, as
watch
you said.
Watch the skies. This was the Cold War, and this was Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
Vampires, zombies, ghouls and creatures from outer space. No, it's not Federal Parliament. It's Sci-Fi and Scream on Joy 94.9.
You can find more Joycasts and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
This podcast was produced by Joy Media. You can support Joy's diverse sound and diverse community this June by donating to Joy Radiothon 2024. Go to joy.org.au/radiothon. And remember, we all flourish with joy.